Chapter 3. Making China Modern. The story of politics in 20th century China has usually been told as a narrative of conflict. In particular, the conflict between the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek and the communists under Mao Zedong. Certainly, the clash between these two parties shaped Chinese life for decades. Chiang's China was marked by the rhetoric of Jiao Fei, bandit extermination, a reference to the elimination of the communists, whom he refused to dignify even with the term party until forced into an alliance with them during the anti-Japanese war. In Mao's China, it was Zheng who was the bogeyman, the corrupt feudal warlord whose family had exploited China for all it was worth until the communists had swept the country clean in 1949. Decades after the deaths of Mao and Zheng, it's possible not only to look at those two major figures with some perspective, but also to pay more attention to the context around them. There is an alternative to regarding the early 20th century as a clash of the two Chinese giants. Instead, we can treat the period from the establishment of Zheng's nationalist government in 1928 to the present day as one long modernizing project by two parties that agreed as well as disagreed. Both the nationalists and the communists wished to establish a strong centralized state, remove imperialist power from China, reduce rural poverty, maintain a one-party state, and create a powerful industrialized infrastructure in China. Both parties launched powerful campaigns against superstition, believing that backward spiritual beliefs were preventing China from reaching modernity. The major ideological difference was that the Chinese Communist Party, CCP, believed that none of these goals, especially rural reform, was possible without major class warfare. The nationalists opposed this, in part because it was captive to forces that opposed economic redistribution. This division led to a deadly falling out by the mid-1920s, which was resolved only by the communist victory in 1949. Ironically, though, by the end of the century, the CCP had also abandoned class war, although only after decades of factional, often highly destructive conflict between classes. The Nationalists in Power. Chiang Kai-shek's nationalist government came to power in 1928 through a combination of military force and popular support. Chiang's bloody tactics had been displayed at Shanghai, then at Canton in 1927, when his henchmen turned on his former communist allies and had thousands of them killed. This action seemed to many to be an augury of the type of government that Chiang would run, keener to use violence than persuasion. His government spoke of the people's rights, one of the three principles of Sun Yat-sen's political philosophy, along with nationalism and the people's livelihood, but it suppressed political dissent with great ruthlessness, using arbitrary arrest and torture, the latter technique characterized by the activities of the nationalist secret service chief, Dai Li. Nationalist governance was marked by corruption and frequent capitulation to the demands of those who had a vested interest in the old order. An indicative figure is that in 1930, China's mortality rate was the highest in the world, more than that of colonial India and 2.5 times that of the US. Yet the nationalist record in office also had significant strengths, which have generally been overlooked. In particular, many of the aspects of contemporary China which have attracted interest today, as well as achievements for which Mao has been given credit, actually originated with the nationalist government. Zhang's government began a major industrialization effort, greatly augmented China's transport infrastructure, and successfully renegotiated many of the unequal treaties which had so blighted relations between China and the imperial powers since the Opium Wars. Throughout its life, though, the government suffered from one crippling reality. Its status as the national government of China was internationally recognized, yet it never really controlled more than a few, albeit very important, provinces, although Zhang's level of influence in Western China grew by the mid-1930s as he allied with regional militarists to drive the communists north. Regional militarists continued to control much of Western China. The Japanese occupied Manchuria in 1931. The communists re-established themselves in the northwest. Yet even Zhang's partial consolidation was quickly shattered in 1937. Free China, the nationalist-controlled interior of the country, was confined to parts of southern and central China during the war years. The final reunification in 1945 came too late for the government to take advantage of it, and the crippled Zhang government gave way to the communists just 4 years later. Chiang was permanently hobbled by having to act as a head of a country which was actually significantly disunited. Furthermore, the causes of some of the horrific realities of early 20th century China were not fully understood at the time. It was commonplace to argue that China's problems stemmed, in part, from too large a population and too little food. Yet it now seems that, although famines did hit parts of China on a regular basis, there was no chronic shortage of food. Rather, appalling levels of hygiene and healthcare before 1949 meant that mortality rates were high, even among a population which had enough to eat overall. Hygiene campaigns under the CCP after 1949 heavily reduced mortality rates even when the population was much larger than a few decades earlier. Nor was the economy as disastrous as has sometimes been implied. Chapter 5. It was assumed for a long time that the traditional handicrafts practiced in the Chinese countryside were destroyed by imperialism and the mechanization it brought along with it. Yet we now know that some traditional handicrafts did remain strong into the 1930s. Although the spinning of yarn by hand had been made obsolete by the development of mechanized cotton mills, the weaving of high-quality handmade cotton and silk cloth was of considerable importance in China's pre-war economy. To make a balanced assessment of the government which ruled China from 1928 to 1949, it's important not to see the nationalists simply as their enemies perceived them, but also in the terms in which they saw themselves. Chiang believed entirely sincerely that his role was to carry out the unfinished revolution of Sun Yat-sen. In this vision, China would be united and the militarist divisions which had torn it apart for two decades would end. China would have a full role in the community of nations, but colonialism on its soil would no longer be permitted. The nationalist vision for China also saw it as an industrialized state. Indeed, it was Sun Yat-sen who first suggested damming the Yangtze to provide electric power, a goal that would eventually be fulfilled some 8 decades later when the Three Gorges Dam opened in 2003. The nationalist vision of China was indubitably modern. It wished to create a self-aware citizenry which would live in a rational, scientific way. For this reason, the nationalists spent significant energy combating superstition, traditional folk customs and religious practices which they felt were out of step with a modern China. Despite his desire to restore some of the supposed traditional values of China that had been undermined by modernity, Chiang Kai-shek also spoke of science as a force that could transform the country into a powerful, independent state. Chiang's government has often been criticized as being in the pay of China's emergent capitalist class. In fact, Shanghai's capitalists had a wary relationship with Chiang, who was keen to raise revenue from them and was not above using extortion to do so. More fundamentally, the nationalists began a project of state-sponsored industrialization and development, much of it in cooperation with the League of Nations, which provided significant technical assistance, the greatest success of which was probably the flood control measures undertaken after the disastrous Yangtze River floods of 1931. The measures were extensive enough that the next big floods in 1935 caused relatively little loss of life. In its first 2 years, the nationalist government also managed to double the length of motor highway in China and increase the number of students studying engineering. State planning has generally been associated with the socialist bloc during the Cold War, but in fact it was widely advocated in democracies and dictatorships alike during the interwar period, Roosevelt's New Deal being a notable example, particularly as the Great Depression encouraged protectionism and turned governments against the idea of letting the unfettered market decide. State planning was at the heart of the nationalists' desire to change China through modernization. In 1934, the nationalists had succeeded in forcing the communists onto the Long March away from Jiangxi Province, a remote, rural part of central China. It was here that Zheng launched his own attempt at an ideological counter-argument to communism, the New Life Movement. This was supposed to be a complete spiritual renewal of the nation through a modernized version of traditional Confucian values such as propriety, righteousness, and loyalty. In terms of personal behavior, the New Life Movement demanded that the renewed citizens of the nation must wear frugal but clean clothes, consume products made in China rather than seek luxurious foreign goods, and behave in a hygienic and ordered way, no wandering out randomly into the roads or urinating in public places. The movement's aims, though, were not traditional but modern. It sought to be a mass movement that would produce a militarized, industrialized, and more culturally aware China. Madam Chiang Kai-shek said of it in 1935, "Mere accumulation of wealth is not sufficient to enable China to resume her position as a great nation. There must also be a revival of the spirit, since spiritual values transcend mere riches." The aim of the movement was to create a citizenry that was self-aware, politically conscious, and committed to the nation. The policy itself was derived from a variety of sources, including Confucianism, muscular Christianity, and social Darwinism. Despite its anti-communism, it shared many values and assumptions with the CCP, with its stress on frugality and collective values, yet it never had much success. While China suffered from a massive agricultural and fiscal crisis, prescriptions about clothes and orderly behavior did not have much popular traction. Why did the grand plans of the nationalists fail, as those of the Qing had failed? Technological modernity was all very well, but much of its impact was confined to the cities and did little to change life on the ground in the countryside, where over 80% of China's people lived. There were exceptions to this, and the role of the railway in shrinking distances within China in the early 20th century should be noted. The nationalists did undertake some rural reform, including the establishment of rural cooperatives in several provinces of China, although their effects were small, with only around 750,000 farmers in cooperatives by 1935. The party also quickly became entwined with the interests of local groups who had little interest in reform and made unwise decisions that weakened their rule. The biggest obstacle to the state's aims was its inability to gather tax revenue. Unable to create a strong central revenue agency, it was reliant on other agencies, including the Maritime Customs, a hybrid organization, part of the Chinese government but headed by a foreigner, usually a Briton, to collect revenue on goods in transit for the Chinese government, and tax farming. The latter meant the devolution of tax collection to local elites, who were then free to extort and bully payments from the wider population. By devolving its tax collection enterprise in this way, the nationalists solved a short-term problem only by an immensely destructive long-term corrosion of public trust in the state's ability to operate honestly and efficiently. But one factor above all affected the ability of the nationalists to establish any kind of stable and effective government: the Sino-Japanese War of 1937-45, known in China as the War of Resistance against Japan. Less than a decade after its establishment, Chiang's government was plunged into total conflict. The 8 years of war devastated China. Exact mortality figures have never been worked out, but a minimum number appears to be around 14 million, with some estimates of dead and wounded as high as 35 million. Some 80 million or more Chinese became refugees. The slowly expanding technological and industrial infrastructure of the previous decade was destroyed, some 52% of the total in Shanghai and some 80% in the abandoned capital of Nanjing. The government had to operate in exile from the far southwestern hinterland of China, as its area of greatest strength and prosperity, China's eastern seaboard, was lost to Japanese occupation. At the same time, the communists, who were forced into the remote northwest after the long march of 1935-6, now found themselves able to consolidate and expand their hold on northern China. Chiang's project of consolidation and unification was thrown into reverse gear. Wartime conditions encouraged corruption, black marketeering, and hyperinflation. The Japanese invasion of China, which began in 1937, was merciless. See Figure 4. Among the many atrocities committed against the population, the most notorious is the Nanjing Massacre, the Rape of Nanking, that took place in the weeks between December 1937 and January 1938. The nationalists had had to abandon their capital, and the city was left defenseless when Japanese troops arrived at the gates. Out-of-control soldiers, unrestrained by their commanders, indulged in weeks of mass killings, rapes, and destruction of property that resulted in tens and quite possibly hundreds of thousands of deaths. Yet this was just one of a series of war crimes committed by the Japanese army during its conquest of eastern China. Nonetheless, the Japanese succeeded in gaining cooperation from some Chinese, many of whom felt that defiance of the Japanese would bring down yet further horrors upon them. This was the justification used by one of Chiang's long-time nationalist rivals, Wang Jingwei, who defected to the Japanese in 1938 and was made president of a reorganized nationalist government at Nanjing in 1940. Wang's government portrayed itself as the real heir to Sun Yat-sen and denounced Zhang as a traitor who had allied with the hated communists, but his regime had no status independent of collaboration with Japan and never achieved mass support. Wang himself died of cancer in 1944. Although Japan was defeated in 1945, post-war China was still in a state of shock. Unlike the pre-war period, food was in genuinely short supply in 1945, as much of China's agricultural heartland had been destroyed, and famine relief supplies from abroad were able to deal with only a small part of the problem. Scarcity caused inflation, to which the government responded by printing money, in part to pay for its huge military commitments. A foolish move, but alternative policies were hard to think of. A large sack of rice increased in price from 6.7 million yuan in June 1948 to 63 million yuan just 2 months later. By the time China was plunged into yet another war, the civil war between the communists and the nationalists, the huge disillusionment with nationalist rule meant that many who were not Marxists by inclination welcomed a communist victory simply because they felt that the nationalists had no credibility left. During all this time, the communists, CCP, had not stood still. After Zhang had turned on them in the cities, most of what remained of the party stole into the countryside, away from Zhang's area of control. A major center of activity was the base area in Jiangxi Province, an impoverished part of central China. It was here, between 1931 and 1935, that the party began to try out systems of government that would eventually bring them to power and shape the People's Republic. After their experience with Zhang, the party felt it essential to train a red army of their own. They also experimented with land redistribution and representative government, although they were wary of alienating local elites while the party was still vulnerable, and therefore did not push policies that might lead to local leaders turning against them. It was during this period that Mao first began to gain power. While he had been one of the earliest members of the CCP, it was the period in the rural areas that allowed him to come to the fore. However, it was also Mao's influence that contributed to increased intra-party violence and more radical attacks on local landowners in the mid-1930s. In addition, by that time, Chiang's previously ineffective, if uncompromisingly named, extermination campaigns were beginning to make the CCP's position in Jiangxi untenable. In 1934, the party began the action that remains a legend to the present day, the Long March. Travelling over 4,000 miles, some 8,000 of the more than 80,000 communists who had set out finally arrived, exhausted, in Shanxi province in the northwest. They were safe, but they were also on the run. It seemed possible that within a matter of months, Zhang would once again attack. See figure 5. The approach of war saved the CCP. There was growing public discontent at Zhang's unwillingness to fight Japan. In fact, this perception was somewhat unfair. The nationalists had undertaken retraining of key regiments in the army under German advice and also started to plan for a wartime economy from 1931, spurred on by the invasion of Manchuria. However, Zhang knew that it would take a long time for China to be capable of resisting the well-trained armies, superb technology and colonial resources of Japan, and preferred an unglamorous but practical solution of diplomatic appeasement. By 1936, however, this was no longer feasible. Events came to a head in December 1936 when the militarist leader of Manchuria, Zhang Zhuliang, and the CCP managed to kidnap Zhang. After negotiations, Zhang confirmed a united front, which had already been under discussion, in which the nationalists and communists would sink their differences and ally against Japan. This development gave the CCP valuable breathing space. They had several areas under their control in wartime China, but the single most famous was the Shanganning base area, with its capital in the small town of Yan'an. However, it was the presence of one figure in particular that made Yan'an an iconic term, Mao Zedong. His credibility as a political figure had been greatly boosted because his advocacy of revolution using the peasantry seemed wiser than the now discredited Soviet-backed policy of urban revolution. Yan'an was not easy to get to, its isolation being an advantage in protecting the area from the nationalists and the Japanese. Mao took advantage of this, using the period to implement a variety of policies that would eventually influence his rule over China. These included attempts to create a self-sufficient economy, tax and land reforms to relieve the poverty of the rural population, and fuller representation for the local population in government. At the same time, Mao reshaped the party in his own image. The party was purified through repeated rectification, Zheng Feng campaigns, which sought to impose an ideological purity on party members based in Mao's own thought rather than encouraging dissent. The American journalist Edgar Snow, who sympathized deeply with the party, traveled to Yunnan and met Mao. In his classic account of that journey, Red Star Over China, he noted in adoring terms of Mao, "He had the simplicity and naturalness of the Chinese peasant, with a lively sense of humor and a love of rustic laughter. He combined curious qualities of naivete with incisive wit and worldly sophistication." By the end of the war with Japan, the communist areas had expanded massively, with some 900,000 troops in the Red Army and party membership at a new high of 1.2 million. For much of the 1930s and into the war years, it was clear that there were two major ideological poles for nationalists who opposed the Japanese presence: Chiang's government at Nanjing, then Chongqing during the war, and Mao's at Yunnan. Both of these offered a powerful vision of modernity, in both cases at odds with the somewhat ramshackle reality of their areas of control. But greater power for one pole sucked it away from the other. In the mid-1930s, the nationalist pole seemed to be gaining strength, but by the mid-1940s, war and its effects had reversed the balance. Above all, the war with Japan had helped the communists come back from the brink of disaster and destroyed the tentative modernization that the nationalists had undertaken. In the aftermath of Japan's defeat, both sides scrambled for power. Unable to reach a compromise, the nationalists and communists plunged into civil war in 1946, a war ended only by victory for the CCP in 1949. Chiang fled to Taiwan, and in Beijing, now restored to its status as the capital, Mao declared the establishment of the People's Republic of China, PRC. Victory in Chongqing. In the center of the city of Chongqing, you'll find a tall piece of statuary, now rather dwarfed by the glass and steel skyscrapers surrounding it. This is the Liberation Monument. There are many references to liberation, Jiefeng, in China today, but almost all these references are to 1949, the year that the communists finally gained control of the Chinese mainland. But in Chongqing, the Liberation Monument originally commemorated another event, the victory over Japan in 1945. It was this moment that marked the turning point on the question, what sort of country would post-war China be? It's worth remembering the assumptions of most Chinese and of the world at large on that day. It was not Mao, but Chiang Kai-shek, as China's leader through 8 years of war, who received the world's accolades and held victory parades through his wartime capital at Chongqing. The assumption of Chiang and the world was that his government would now take up the state-building project that he had begun in the 1920s. The West certainly assumed that Chiang would be in power for years. President Roosevelt had characterized China as one of the four policemen, along with the US, USSR, and Britain, that would monitor the post-war world. Prime Minister Churchill had far less enthusiasm for treating Chiang as a serious global figure, but he did not see him losing power. Certainly, China's determination to last out through the war had reaped rewards on the global stage. In 1943, all of the unequal treaties that had plagued Chinese-Western relations for a century had finally been ended. In 1946, China would become one of the five permanent members of the Security Council of the new United Nations. Huge international aid efforts were made to relieve the desperate poverty in China's cities and countryside. The assumption on all sides, including Stalin's USSR, was that China would remain in the Western bloc in the emerging Cold War. Within 5 years, it all went wrong for Chiang. Why? Most histories have laid the blame squarely at the feet of Chiang and the nationalists, and they must surely take a large part of the responsibility. Large swathes of the population were branded as collaborators, with little understanding shown for the dilemmas that had faced those who had to decide whether to flee or stay in the face of Japanese invasion. Many of the officials installed in the restored nationalist government were corrupt and inefficient. Within months, the goodwill of victory was being squandered. Was the communist victory a military one or a social one? The two aspects are not easily separated. The Chinese Communist Party, CCP, had little chance to implement serious land reform before 1949 in most areas of China. During the Civil War, it simply did not have that level of control over the population. Without the brilliant military tactics of Lin Biao and the other PLA, People's Liberation Army, generals, social reform on its own would not have been enough to bring the CCP victory. On the other hand, it was clear by 1948 that while Jiang's armies had the support of the US and superiority in terms of finance and troop numbers, their morale was slipping away. The goodwill from victory over Japan had not been transferred to the CCP, but it was no longer with the nationalists. Their chance for unity had been squandered. By the time Mao declared the establishment of the People's Republic of China, PRC, in 1949, China's path was not in doubt. The year 1949 was not in itself the turning point, but the result of choices made in 1945. China was going to have a communist government allied to the USSR and largely closed to the West. Mao in power. Mao's China was very different from Jiang's in a variety of ways. Perhaps overall, the most powerful change was encapsulated in the slogan, "Politics in Command," which was used during the Great Leap Forward campaign of 1958-62. Chiang had been concerned to create a politically aware citizenry through campaigns such as the New Life Movement, but these had failed to penetrate very successfully. Mao's China had much greater control over its population and did not hesitate to use it. Its politics was essentially modern in that it demanded mass participation in which the citizenry, the people, saw itself as part of a state project based on a shared class and national identity. The success of Mao's military and political tactics also meant that the country was, for the first time since the 19th century, united under a strong central government. Mao's China is often characterized as isolated. It's certainly true that most Western influence was removed from the country. The large numbers of businessmen, missionaries, and educators, many of whom had spent their lives in China, were almost all expelled by 1952. However, China was now exposed to a new sort of foreign influence, the new dominance of the Soviet Union in the still-emerging Cold War. The 1950s marked the high point of Soviet influence on Chinese politics and culture. Soviet diplomats, technical missions, economists, and writers all played their part in shaping the new communist China. Yet the decade also saw rising tension between the Chinese and the Soviets, fueled in part by Khrushchev's condemnation of Stalin, which Mao took in part as a criticism of his own cult of personality, as well as cultural misunderstandings on both sides. The differences between the two sides came to a head in 1960 with the withdrawal of Soviet technical assistance from China, and Sino-Soviet relations remained frosty until the 1980s. The People's Republic used its state power in one way that was very different from the aims of Chiang's China, the pursuit of class warfare. Mao had finally risen to undisputed leadership of the CCP during the war period, and his writings made it clear that when he finally gained power, moderation and restraint were to be shunned. Revolution, he famously claimed in 1927 in his Report on an Investigation of the Peasant Movement in Hunan, is not a dinner party. It cannot be so refined, so leisurely and gentle, so temperate, kind, courteous, restrained and magnanimous. A revolution is an insurrection. An act of violence by which one class overthrows another. Certainly, the years of war and the failure of the nationalists genuinely to reform social relations in rural China meant that there was a widespread constituency in favor of violent change, driven by a conviction that previous attempts to change the structure of rural society had failed. The initial period of land reform in China in 1949-50 saw some 40% of the land redistributed and some 60% of the population benefiting from the change. Perhaps 1 million people who were condemned as landlords were persecuted and killed, see figure 6. Yet this violence was not random. Official campaigns were instigated that oversaw and encouraged terror. The joy of liberation was real for many Chinese at the time, but the early 1950s were not a golden age when China was truly at peace. The urgency came from the continuing desire of the CCP to modernize China. The PRC had to deal with the reality of its situation in the early Cold War, The US refused to recognize the government in Beijing, and although other Western countries did open up diplomatic relations, the country was economically relatively isolated, even though it now had a formal cooperative relationship with the USSR. When relations with the Soviets also started becoming chillier in the mid-1950s, as Mao expressed his anger at the Khrushchev thaw, the CCP leader's thoughts turned to self-sufficiency as an alternative. Mao proposed the policy known as the Great Leap Forward. This was a highly ambitious plan to use the power of socialist economics to increase Chinese production of steel, coal, and electricity. Agriculture was to reach an ever higher level of collectivization, with individual plots, the basis of the popular land reforms of Mao's first years in power, being subsumed into large collective farms. Family structures were broken up as communal dining halls were established. People were urged to eat their fill, as the new agricultural methods would ensure plenty for all year after year. The Minister of Agriculture, Tan Junlin, declared, "After all, what does communism mean? First, taking good food and not merely eating one's fill. At each meal, one enjoys a meat diet, eating chicken, pork, fish or eggs. Delicacies like monkey brains, swallow's nests and white fungi are served to each according to his needs." The plan was fueled by a strong belief that political will, combined with scientific Marxism, would produce an economic miracle of which capitalism simply was not capable. Yet its goal was unquestionably one of modernization through industrial technology. The stated goal of the leap was to overtake Britain in 15 years, and by this it was Britain's industrial capability, not its wheat fields or cattle, that was meant. The leap has been interpreted as an example of how Mao's dominance over the CCP ended the possibilities of real debate within the leadership. When Peng Dehuai, the defense minister, tried to point out the hardships caused by the leap at the 1959 party conference at Lushan, he was abruptly dismissed from his post. Nonetheless, it should be noted that Mao was not alone in advocating the start of the leap. Figures such as Chen Yin, the chief economic planner in the Politburo, were also highly supportive. The leap engendered great enthusiasm around the country, with Chinese in rural and urban areas alike taking part in mass campaigns that were not just economic, but cultural and artistic as well. The breakdown of traditional family structures during the leap helped to redefine women's roles, stressing their status as workers of equal standing to men. See Figure 7. Still, the Great Leap Forward was a monumental failure. It can hardly be defined as anything else, as its methods caused a massive famine, whose effects were dismissed by Mao, and caused some 20 million or more deaths. Its modernizing aims were dashed in the face of reality. Yet the return to a more pragmatic economic model in agriculture and industry when the leap ended in 1962 did not dampen Mao's enthusiasm for revolutionary renewal as well as ideological success. By this time, the alliance with the Soviet Union had broken up in acrimony, and Soviet criticisms of Mao's radicalism spurred him on rather than restraining his actions. This led to the last and most bizarre of the campaigns that marked Mao's China, the Cultural Revolution of 1966-76. In fact, the part of the Cultural Revolution that has remained in popular memory, teenage Red Guards persecuting their teachers, massive crowds of youth in Tiananmen Square hoping for a sight of Chairman Mao, date from the early period, 1966-1969. But the whole decade marked the final rallying call for a particular type of self-contradictory modernity which Mao hoped to instill. An industrialized state which valued peasant labor and was free of the bourgeois influence of the city. Mao had become increasingly concerned that post-leap China was slipping into economism, a complacent satisfaction with rising standards of living that would blunt people's revolutionary fervor. In addition, in the mid-1960s, the first generation was coming of age that had never known any life except that under the CCP, and therefore had no personal experience of the poverty and warfare that had afflicted their parents' generation. For these reasons, Mao decided that a massive campaign of ideological renewal must be launched, in which he would attack his own party. Mao was still the dominant figure in the CCP, and used his prestige to undermine his own colleagues. In summer 1966, prominent posters in large, handwritten characters appeared at prominent sites, including Peking University, demanding that figures such as Liu Shaoqi, president of the PRC, and Deng Xiaoping, senior Politburo member, must be condemned as takers of the capitalist road. The outside world looked on, uncomprehending, as top leaders suddenly disappeared from sight to be replaced by little-known figures such as Mao's wife, Jiang Qing, and her associates, later to be dubbed the Gang of Four. Meanwhile, an all-pervasive cult of Mao's personality took over. A million youths at a time, known as Red Guards, would flock to hear Mao in Tiananmen Square. Posters and pictures of Mao were everywhere. Some 2.2 billion Mao badges had been cast by 1969. Personal devotion to Mao was now essential. For example, in June 1966, Red Guards of the high school attached to Tsinghua University declared in an oath of loyalty, "We are Chairman Mao's Red Guard, and Chairman Mao is our highest leader. We have unlimited trust in the people. We have the deepest hatred for our enemies. In life, we struggle for the party. In death, we give ourselves up for the benefit of the people. With our blood and our lives, we swear to defend Chairman Mao. Chairman Mao, we have unlimited faith in you." The Cultural Revolution was not just a power grab within the leadership. The rhetoric that flowed from the Cultural Revolution showed that not only was this a movement of great ideological conviction, but one that, despite its seeming irrationality, reflected a particular type of modernity very strongly. The great proletarian cultural revolution now unfolding is a great revolution that touches people to their very souls, began the CCP Central Committee's decision concerning the great proletarian cultural revolution, 8th of August 1966. The Red Guards, Chinese youth who were encouraged to rise up against their elders, embraced the call to revolution. Revolutionary dialectics tells us that the newborn forces are invincible, that they inevitably grow and develop in struggle, and in the end defeat the decaying forces. Therefore, we shall certainly sing the praises of the new, eulogize it, beat the drums to encourage it, bang the gongs to clear a way for it, and raise our hands high in welcome. Just as Stalin had characterized the job of party-sponsored artists in the USSR to be the engineers of human souls, so the Cultural Revolution was meant to provide a retooling of Chinese society to become a renewed, self-aware citizenry finally free from the shackles of the past. Like their revolutionary predecessors in the USSR, and indeed in 18th century France, the Red Guards were not ashamed to admit that their tactics were violent. A group of youths in Harbin in 1966 declared, "Today we will carry out Red Terror, and tomorrow we will carry out Red Terror. As long as there are things in existence which are not in accordance with Mao Zedong thought, we must rebel and carry out Red Terror." With its obsessive emphasis on violence as a supposedly desirable and transformative force, the Cultural Revolution was a highly modern movement. And while Mao initiated and supported it, it also had widespread support. It was a genuinely mass political movement which left many youths feeling as if they had had the best days of their lives. It was strongly anti-intellectual and xenophobic, condemning those such as doctors or teachers who were accused of being expert rather than red, and casting suspicions on anyone who had connections with the outside world, whether the Western or the Soviet bloc. However, it also drew on Mao's conviction that the party had become soft and too comfortable with power, obsessed with urban concerns. Movements such as the Barefoot Doctor Program took off during these years. Scorning the Ministry of Health as the Ministry of Urban Gentlemen's Health, Mao promoted a policy by which the peasants themselves were given the opportunity to train in basic medicine and provide health care in the villages. Although inadequate in many ways, the program brought healthcare to parts of China which had had few such facilities, even in the years after 1949. Yet the Cultural Revolution could not last. Worried at the increasing violence in the streets, the party leadership ordered the People's Liberation Army, PLA, China's official armed forces, to send the Red Guards back home in 1969. The policies of the Cultural Revolution remained official dogma until 1976. However, from the early 1970s, profound changes began in Chinese politics. The long-standing policy of isolation was clearly not working. The period, however, saw a remarkable rapprochement between the United States and China, which had no official relations since 1949. The former was desperate to extricate itself from the quagmire of Vietnam, the latter terrified of an attack from the now hostile USSR, and in turmoil after the sudden defection and death in an air crash of Mao's putative successor, Defense Minister Lin Biao. Secretive diplomatic maneuvers led, eventually, to the official visit of US President Richard Nixon to China in 1972, which began the reopening of China to the West, although it would be more than a decade before ordinary Chinese and foreigners would be able to meet each other in any numbers within China itself. Slowly, the Cultural Revolution began to thaw, and that thaw would be accelerated by the death of its architect. Geiger Kaifeng, Reform and Opening Up. Mao died in 1976. His successor was the little-known Hua Guofeng. Within 2 years, Hua had been outmaneuvered by the greatest survivor of 20th-century Chinese politics, Deng Xiaoping. Deng had joined the CCP in 1924. He'd been purged twice during the Cultural Revolution, but his connections had been strong enough to keep him safe, and after Mao's death, he was able to reach supreme leadership in the CCP with a program startlingly different from that of the late chairman. Deng took as his personal slogan the expression, "Seek truth from facts," a term Mao had actually used in the 1930s, but which Deng adopted to indicate that he felt that truth and facts had been largely lacking from the political scene during the Cultural Revolution. In particular, Deng recognized that the Cultural Revolution's profound anti-intellectualism and xenophobia were proving economically damaging to China. Deng took up a policy slogan originally invented by Mao's pragmatic prime minister and second-in-command, Zhou Enlai, the Four Modernizations. This had been effectively an admission by moderates in the CCP leadership that the Cultural Revolution had led China away from the path of genuine modernization. Now, the party's task would be to set China on the right path in four areas: agriculture, industry, science and technology, and national defense. To do so, many of the assumptions of the Mao era were abandoned. The first, highly symbolic move of the reform era, as the period since 1978 is known, was the breaking down over time of the agricultural collective farms that had been instituted under Mao. Farmers, in particular, were able to sell an ever larger proportion of their crops on the free market, and it was stated explicitly that cash crops and small private plots of land were an essential part of the economy and should not be interfered with. Urban and rural areas were also encouraged to set up small local or household enterprises, with nearly 12 million such enterprises registered by 1985. Economic equality was no longer the goal of government. As part of the encouragement of entrepreneurship, Deng designated four areas on China's coast as special economic zones, which would be particularly attractive to foreign investors, thereby ending the preference for self-sufficiency that had marked the economy under Mao. Chapter 5. Yet the doors were opened only a certain way. In December 1978, a young man named Wei Jingsheng used the new openness to demand the fifth modernization, true democracy in China. He was quickly arrested and stayed in prison almost constantly until 1997, when he was exiled to the US. Nonetheless, the 1980s were marked by a remarkable openness, greater than under Mao. In politics, the drive for renewal became linked with a powerful desire to reopen China to the outside world. In 1979, full diplomatic relations were finally established between China and the US, and from the early 1980s, foreign tourists and students began to visit China in large numbers, just as a new generation of Chinese began to study and do business abroad. Deng Xiaoping was indubitably the senior figure in the party, and he made it clear that he favored economic reform at the fastest possible speed. In the 1980s, the USSR was still intact, but the West regarded that country as a stagnant and hostile giant, at least until the arrival of Mikhail Gorbachev to the leadership in 1985. In contrast, China seemed to be the communist giant that the West loved to love. Keen to grow the economy, friendly towards the US, Deng Xiaoping even visited Texas and wore a Stetson at a rodeo. At home, cowboys of a different sort also found their moment as the economy grew by leaps and bounds. Notoriously, in 1985, the party chief of Hainan Island, Lei Yu, had used valuable foreign exchange to import 79,000 foreign cars, 347,000 televisions, and 45,000 motorcycles for resale at inflated prices. Yet Lei was rehabilitated in 1988, and his behaviour was only the most outrageous example of a widespread phenomenon of corruption. The signals that the economy should change and grow were unmistakable. In the political sphere, however, the signals were mixed. Deng had supported the rise to power of Hu Yaobang, a relatively liberal member of the Politburo, under whose influence there was a significant rise in the level of debate in journals and think tanks, which had previously been under the moribund influence of a monolithic party line. Deng was relaxed about a certain amount of ideological impurity coming along with the reforms. "If you open the window," he observed, "some flies will get in." Yet not all the leadership were as sanguine. Chun Yun, the archetypal central planner, and propaganda chief Hu Qiamu were among those who were concerned by the materialism and ideological vacuousness that they perceived in reform-era China. They supported a series of campaigns, usually under the title of anti-spiritual pollution and spiritual civilization, in which noxious influences from the capitalist world would be condemned. In the 1980s, politics tended to open up, only to be thrown into partial reverse after a couple of years. Yet the movement seemed to be inevitably towards a freer, market-oriented society. The group which benefited most greatly from the reforms, in contrast with the Cultural Revolution, were intellectuals, a grab-bag category in the Chinese understanding, which includes academics and students, as well as more abstract thinkers. No longer were they termed the stinking ninth, that is, the ninth class of undesirables in Cultural Revolution terminology. Instead, education was encouraged, as China strove to improve its science and technology infrastructure. Yet the new freedoms that intellectuals enjoyed gave them the appetite for more. After student protests in 1985-6 demanding further opening up of the party, Hu Yaobang was forced to resign in 1987 and take responsibility for allowing social forces to get out of control. He was replaced as general secretary by Zhao Ziyong, who was perceived as politically less liberal, although just as strong an economic reformer. The complaints of the intellectuals were not just abstract, however. Most of them, in particular academics and students at universities, were on fixed state incomes, and as inflation began to run rife in newly rich reform-era China, they began to find that their income was rapidly becoming insufficient to cover their needs. In April 1989, Hu Yaobang died. It was a long-standing tradition in China that the death of a well-respected figure could trigger demonstrations. In this case, students around China used the occasion of his death to organize protests against the continuing role of the CCP in public life. At Peking University, the breeding ground of the May 4th demonstrations of 1919, students published journals with titles such as New May 4th and declared the need for science and democracy, the modernizing watchwords of 80 years earlier, to be revived. On the 4th of May 1989 itself, protesters in Tiananmen Square held up signs written in Chinese and English reading "Hello, Mr. Democracy," a clear reference to the May 4th duo, Mr. Science and Mr. Democracy, who had been tasked with China's salvation 70 years earlier. In spring 1989, Tiananmen Square in Beijing was the scene of an unprecedented demonstration. At its height, nearly a million Chinese workers and students, in a cross-class alliance rare by the late 20th century, filled the space in front of the Gate of Heavenly Peace. See figure 8. The party was profoundly embarrassed to have the world's media record events. They had been there for a historic occasion, the first visit of the reforming Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. But the event had turned to farce, as Gorbachev was escorted via a roundabout route to avoid him seeing the demonstrations. By June 1989, the numbers in the square had dwindled only to thousands, but they showed no signs of moving. On the night of the 3rd to the 4th of June, the party acted, sending in tanks and armored personnel carriers. The death toll has never been officially confirmed, but it seems likely to have been in the high hundreds or even more. Hundreds of people associated with the movement were arrested, imprisoned, or forced to flee to the West. It seemed to many that the hardliners had won and that the chance for science and democracy had ended. China since 1989. In retrospect, now that Tiananmen Square is more than two decades in the past, the surprising thing is what did not happen. China did not, as many feared, plunge into civil war. It did not reverse the economic reforms. It did not close itself off to the outside world. For some 3 years, politics did indeed go into a deep freeze. The liberal trends that had fueled the protests of the late 1980s were now regarded as evil winds of bourgeois liberalism. But in 1992, Deng, the man who had sent in the tanks, was now 88 years old. He must have known that his legacy might seem similar to that of Gorbachev, a reformer perceived, at least in Chinese eyes, to have failed. That year, he undertook what was ironically called his southern tour, the Chinese term Nanjing, referring to the emperor visiting his furthest domains. By visiting Shenzhen, the boomtown on the border with Hong Kong, and appearing to local news reporters riding a golf buggy in a theme park, Deng indicated that the economic policies of reform were not going to be abandoned. He had made other important choices. Jiang Zemin, the mayor of Shanghai, had effectively dissolved demonstrations in Shanghai in a way that the authorities in Beijing had not. He was groomed as the next senior leader, having been appointed general secretary of the party in 1989. Furthermore, his home city, Shanghai, was finally given permission to attract foreign investment on a lavish scale, having been kept on a tight leash under Mao and in the initial period of reform. For a century, from the 1840s to the 1940s, Shanghai had been the motor of China's industry, commerce and culture, an outward-looking metropolis that regarded itself as a world city rather than just Chinese. Now, it was being given permission to recreate the experience. The post-Deng leadership has taken on something like a regular pattern. Jiang Zemin, the former mayor of Shanghai, became party general secretary in 1989. The 14th and 15th Party Congresses in 1992 and 1997 each signalled another five-year term for Jiang in that role, but despite strong rumours that he wished to stay on, the 16th and 17th Party Congresses in 2002 and 2007 confirmed Hu Jintao as Jiang's successor. It is possible also to detect changes in policy emphasis between the two leaders. Jiang's period in office was marked by a breakneck enthusiasm for economic development, along with cautious political reform, for instance, the growth of local elections at village level, but certainly no move to democracy at higher levels. Between 2002 and 2012, Hu and his prime minister, Wen Jiabao, made more efforts to deal with the inequality and poverty in the countryside. The year 2012 saw an important generational shift. In spring that year, China felt the biggest political shock in decades as the charismatic party secretary of Chongqing, Bo Xilai, fell from office amid lurid accusations of corruption, abuse of power, and even murder. Bo had been tipped by many, not least himself, to rise to the highest level of politics, the Standing Committee of the Politburo, and his fall and subsequent trial and conviction were seen as his punishment for attempting to bypass the existing power networks. In autumn that year, the leadership passed to a new party general secretary, Xi Jinping. In the following years, Xi swiftly centralized many powers under himself, thereby defining the next round of economic and political change in a highly personalized way. At the same time, his government sponsored a new rhetoric of a Chinese renaissance, along with a severe anti-corruption campaign that aimed at prominent targets ranging from a well-known television host to China's former top security chief, Zhou Yongkang. Chinese media and academia were also placed under new restrictions, with freedom to debate political change in terms of democracy or constitutional change being actively discouraged. In the end, the economy will be the most important factor in deciding whether China's current political system will endure. Since the 1990s, China has embraced economic reform with a vengeance. Its politics does not have the liberal, almost naive interest in the West that it did in the 1980s. One of the most influential intellectuals of the early 21st century, the philosopher Wang Hui, declared that the new Enlightenment wave of the 1980s, which ultimately led to Tiananmen Square, was unable to come to any understanding of the fact that China's problems are also the problems of the world capitalist market. Finally, it was unable to recognize the futility of using the West as a yardstick in the critique of China. But in many ways, China is far more influenced by globalized modernity than even in the 1980s. China has placed scientific development at the centre of its quest for growth, sending students abroad not in their hundreds, but tens of thousands, to study science and technology, just as the nationalist government of the 1930s tried to develop an indigenous core of engineers and technicians. The country also has a powerful international role in the early 21st century. China has sought economic and diplomatic influence in Africa and South America, taking advantage of a general suspicion in the global south of the Western post-Cold War order. However, China's international influence has been hampered by two tendencies. In areas outside Asia, China's preference is for remaining neutral but friendly and to commit to few outright statements of policy. Yet crises in the Middle East, the Korean Peninsula, and Ukraine, and the scramble for mineral resources in Africa and energy resources around the globe may make it harder to claim a status as a world power without providing action or using influence. Meanwhile, Chinese actions in its own backyard in the early 2010s, in particular territorial and maritime claims in the East and South China Seas, have made some neighboring countries wary of growing Chinese influence in the region. Particularly as its defense budget soars. It was $131 billion in 2014. Although Chinese behavior in Asia veers between hard and soft tactics, it's still unclear whether Beijing has worked out a real strategy to increase its influence in the region through consensus rather than coercion. Nationalism has also become a popular rallying cry at home. This does not necessarily mean xenophobia or anti-foreignism, although there are occasions, such as the reaction to the 1999 NATO bombing of the Chinese embassy in Belgrade during the Kosovo War, that have led to violence against foreign targets and persons. But it's clear that China's own people consider that the country's moment has arrived, and that they must oppose attempts, whether by the West or Japan, to prevent it taking center stage in the region. A modern politics? A popular characterization of China's leaders of the 20th century, particularly Mao, is that they've sought to become new emperors in their own right. Although it is a colorful shorthand, such a comparison is misleading. It highlights the exotic element of Chinese politics and conceals the reality that many of the assumptions and models that have shaped Chinese political thinking in the present century are profoundly modern and indeed similar to those in the West. Chinese politics since the late Qing has been dependent on nationalism, an idea that derived its legitimacy from the people as a body in their own right, and an idea that a strong state would be a rational arbiter of power. It was based on mass politics, where there was a social contract between government and citizen. While the Confucian mode of governance did also embody a sort of social contract between emperor and subject, it did not think it seemly that the people should be empowered in their own right. A profoundly non-modern way of thought. This does not mean that the Confucian past simply disappeared with the arrival of modern politics. For instance, assumptions that came from a modernized Confucianism did remain, such as ideas of hierarchy and mutual obligation. But these ideas have become adapted through contact with the assumptions of modernity about mass participation and legitimacy derived from the people, as well as the importance of the individuate itself. There is a final irony that has been implied but not stated in the way in which this chapter has portrayed Chinese politics since the establishment of Zheng's nationalist government in 1928 through the victory of the Communist Party in 1949 to the present era as a passing on of the baton in a wider, consistent politics of modernity. For the political form of China today, a one-party state that does still allow a significant amount of individual autonomy, a powerful state with a role in the international order which is partly cooperative and partly confrontational, and a highly successful semi-capitalist economy in which the state and party still play a significant, embedded role, means that the Communist Party of today has essentially created the state sought by the progressive wing of the nationalists in the 1930s rather than the dominant radical communists of the 1960s. One can imagine Chiang Kai-shek's ghost wandering round China today nodding in approval, while Mao's ghost follows behind him, moaning at the destruction of his vision. The intellectual assumptions behind both the nationalists and the communists in the last century were similar in many important ways, making this seeming paradox perfectly comprehensible if examined in a somewhat long durée that extends back before 1978 or 1949.